We've been hearing about some potential running mates for Mitt Romney this week. Yesterday, we profiled Ohio Senator Rob Portman and asked whether he's a safe choice or a choice that would bring some sizzle to the ticket. Today, the same question about another man who appears on many lists of potential running mates, Tim Pawlenty, the former Republican governor of Minnesota. NPR's Brian Naylor has this profile.
As he shadowed President Obama's bus tour in Pennsylvania early this month, Tim Pawlenty gave a pretty good impression of a man auditioning for a job. There was Pawlenty as a tack dog, one of the traditional roles of a running mate.
I don't know if he's not listening, or he doesn't care, or he doesn't understand, but we've had enough of his teleprompter speeches. We've had enough of him flapping his jaws. We've got too many Americans who are hurting, too many Americans who are unemployed, too many Americans who are underemployed.
And there was Pawlenty as lawyer lieutenant, heaping praise on the presumptive Republican nominee.
Mitt Romney's got a tremendous vision for this country. It's a vision not based on a European style of more government everything. It's based on the American tradition of limited government. He's got proposals to lower taxes for businesses and for individuals. He wants to get federal spending under control. That's the kind of direction America needs.
51-year-old Tim Pawlenty's background couldn't be more different from Mitt Romney's. He's the son of a truck driver. His mother died while he was young. He's an evangelical Christian. Ben Golnick served as Pawlenty's press secretary during his brief presidential run last year. He says Pawlenty's modest upbringing helps him connect with people.
Whether it's going into a VFW lodge or going to a Chamber of Commerce meeting, talking to businessmen and women, or talking to a group of CEOs from Fortune 500 companies, he's very comfortable in his own skin. He's genuine. He's authentic. And I think that that quality, being able to communicate effectively, would serve him well in the Midwest and some of the Rust Belt states with blue-collar workers, some of those Reagan Democrats.
Pawlenty's two terms as governor of Minnesota and the fact he was considered as John McCain's running mate in 2008 helped make him a safe pick for Romney. There's been some grumbling in the conservative blogosphere that he's insufficiently conservative. He once supported a cap-and-trade solution to global warming and raised taxes on tobacco in Minnesota. Former Republican Congressman Vin Weber of Minnesota says the carping is nonsense.
We went through all this when Tim ran for president, and he did change his mind on the issue of cap and trade and on the broader issue of how we should approach climate change. But other than that, you know, I just got to tell you, coming from the state of Minnesota, home of Hubert Humphrey, Walter Mondale, Eugene McCarthy, Paul Wellstone, Al Franken, he is the most conservative governor in my lifetime, by far.
During the GOP primary campaign, Pawlenty criticized Romney's stance on health care, dubbing the plan he implemented as Massachusetts governor Obamacare. He backed away from the characterization during one debate with Romney, but given the chance at a subsequent debate, he returned to it.
Look, Obamacare was patterned after Mitt's plan in Massachusetts. And for Mitt or anyone else to say that there aren't substantial similarities or they're not essentially the same plan, it just is incredible. So that's why I called it Obamacare, and I think that's a fair label, and I'm happy to call it that again tonight.
That difference seems to have been patched over. Pawlenty's biggest drawback, or maybe biggest plus as a candidate, could be his lack of sizzle. He jokes about it, yesterday offering to show a Fox interviewer his tats. But Vin Weber, who, by the way, is an unpaid advisor to Romney and neutral in the Veep stakes, says Pawlenty is solid and tested, which may be all he needs.
Republicans who want to compete with President Obama on the charisma scale, I think, are going to find themselves disappointed no matter who they choose. I don't think that that's the contrast that wins us the White House. I think the country will warm to him very quickly and find a lot of charm and a lot of maybe more low-key charisma, but nonetheless charisma.
Weber and other Republicans say Pawlenty is ready to assume the presidency if need be. And perhaps equally important, Romney is said to be comfortable with him. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Now, a postcard of sorts for our series, Wish You Were Here. Writers have been telling us about must-see places. Today, Pam Houston. She's known for writing that captures the American West, But she takes us now to Dawn in Southeast Asia.
Luang Prabang, Laos is so close to the equator that daybreak happens at the same time each day. Also each day, a few dozen women, wives, mothers, homemakers, set up rice cookers on small collapsible tables every few street corners. If you get up with them and walk the silent streets in the misty Mekong pre-dawn, you smell, under the sweetness of the frangipani blossoms, the thick odor of cooked starch. I'm a mountain girl, and my first love in Asia are the monasteries tucked between the snow-covered razor ridges of the high Himalayas. But I've been drawn south, into these humid lowlands, by the reported kindness of the Laotian people and the early morning ritual that is about to begin. A rooster crows, a peacock screams, and then the bells of the monasteries begin to have their morning conversation. When the monks come pouring down the stone steps of the prayer halls, they appear first as a river of color, a ribbon of saffron silk, shockingly vibrant against the chalky streets, the dusty footpath, the gray, almost mercuried sky. All over Asia, monks wear robes the color of spices, curry, cumin, paprika. In Luang Prabang, every robe is bright as saffron, the cloth wrapped complicatedly around their torsos and hanging to their ankles, tied at the waist with a bright yellow sash. Hands clasped in front of the belly, echoing the shape of the wooden begging bowl they hold. Like the Mekong they live beside, this river of men never stops moving. They pass in a quiet, contemplative gait that is two parts walking, one part floating. One by one, they drift past the woman, who also keeps a kind of time with her motions. One large scoop of steaming rice into each hand-carved bowl, refill, release, refill again. Every monk bows to her deeply and moves on. Three streets over, the same thing is happening. Different woman, different monks, same bright, graceful river passing in front of her. A few streets beyond, an unmistakable flash of color, and again, a few streets beyond that. This is what happens here every morning. 365 days, year in, year out, the women up early cooking in the dark, carrying their little tables in the milky first light. Then the monks, a small fire in the gray dawn, lightening their rice cookers, lightening their burdens. The sun strengthens slightly. In an hour, the fog will lift and the heat will begin to press down. There's a flick of fire, a swirl of a saffron sleeve as a monk moves around the corner, back up the stairs and into the dormitory. Like a magic trick of compassion, of generosity, of prayers offered and received.
Pam Houston, with her appreciation of sunrise in Luang Prabang, Laos. Houston is the author most recently of the novel Contents May Have Shifted.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you want to give a thrill to the medieval clothing historian in your life, give her a big pile of linen rags and make sure some really old bras are in there.
One of them has actually two separate cups for the breasts and then has two straps that go over each shoulder.
That's Hilary Davidson, fashion curator and medieval clothes expert at the Museum of London. And she's talking about four items among thousands of textiles discovered between the floorboards of an Austrian castle. The material was stuffed there during a 15th century renovation.
The bras seem to be made of very fine linen and are beautifully embellished with an early form of needle lace.
Those garments were uncovered in 2008 by a research team from Austria's University of Innsbruck. And while they are worn and raggedy, they are very well preserved. Carbon dating has now confirmed their age. Yes, these are 600-year-old bras. That's a surprising discovery, since the notion of a single garment to lift and separate the breasts is thought to be a modern development dating from the late 19th century.
Exactly what medieval women wore under their clothes has long been somewhat of a mystery, though Hilary Davidson says there have been clues.
There are some references to women wearing what translates as breast bags in 15th century Germanic regions. But like so many things, we only find out about this because people complain about them, usually men.
Including one unknown 15th century German writer who put his complaints about the Tuttensack, or breast bag, into satirical verse.
Many women make two breast bags. With them she roams the streets so that all the young men that look at her can see her beautiful breasts. But whose breasts are too large makes tight pouches, so there is no gossip in the city about her big breasts. I mean, it's so modern.
Researchers think the bras were likely worn as a fashion statement by well-off Germanic women. As for their modern aspects, we don't think we'll see Gisele Bündchen in a Victoria's Secret Tuttensack anytime soon.
This summer, we're exploring our parents' music and the impact it made on us. We've heard from writers, musicians, even a politician, about one song introduced by a parent that left a lasting impression. Today we meet a musician who was born to American musical royalty.
My name is Ravi Coltrane. I'm a tenor saxophonist and composer.
Ravi Coltrane is the son of jazz icon John Coltrane, and his mother, Alice Coltrane, was a renowned jazz pianist and composer. His father died when he was very young, and while Ravi Coltrane now plays jazz, it was his mother's love for a different kind of music that produced a childhood soundtrack for him and his siblings.
I remember my mother playing lots of symphonic music. Specifically, my mom was a great admirer of Igor Stravinsky's music. Her favorite pieces were the Rite of Spring and more so the Firebird Suite. We used to dance around to it, you know, like we were on a stage. It is a ballet, the Firebird, so we were sort of channeling that idea.
So you heard it a lot.
Yes, we did.
It's fairly sophisticated music for a young child to be hearing. Could you relate to it? Did it make an impression on you?
It did. You know, there was something very compelling about it. You know, it was very different than the music that we were accustomed to hearing as young kids growing up in the mid-late 60s, you know, R&B music. And my mother's from Detroit, so a lot of Motown-influenced music. And, of course, my mother being Alice Coltrane, her, you know, she was very active in recording and performing during that time. So, you know, we heard music constantly, but there was something about the Firebird that really spoke to us.
Can you recall a specific moment when you remember hearing Stravinsky or a specific part of the Firebird, for that matter?
Yeah, we loved the finale. You know, the very end of the piece begins in this very tranquil way, and then it builds into this very dramatic overture of this very simple theme. But yeah, something very dramatic and very powerful would always sort of engage us as young kids.
These days, do you ever go back and listen to Stravinsky just for enjoyment?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I'm very fortunate and lucky to have that kind of continuity, I guess, with my musical past. You know, a lot of that music is still very, very important for me. It was only recent that I found the recording that my mom used to play, the actual album, and it's the Columbia Symphony Orchestra version that Stravinsky conducts himself. Hearing that version again, it really brought me back to Dix Hills, Long Island, you know, late 60s. Just the sound of that recording, and obviously the effect that the composer conducting his own work, you know, had on the piece. It still had the same power. I still have that Firebird cover, and I have it up in my studio. I was going to put it in a frame, but I just have it sitting up, you know, near some other little artifacts. So when I'm not listening to the music, I can look at the cover, and it's almost like the same thing for me.
Well, Ravi Coltrane, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Saxophonist and composer Ravi Coltrane talking about Igor Stravinsky's Firebird Suite as part of our series Mom and Dad's Record Collection. His mother, Alice Coltrane, introduced that music to him. We leave you with some contemporary Coltrane from Ravi's new album, Spirit Fiction. And you can write to us your stories about one song introduced to you by a parent. Write to us at npr.org and put Parents Music in your subject line.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Peter Alina. We had engineering support from Stu Rushfield.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Art Silverman, Jonathan Baer, Rob Ballinger, Brendan Banizak, Janae West, Bilal Qureshi, Theo Balcom, Melissa Gray, and Jessica Diehl.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas Alliance, representing the natural gas industry and supporting nearly 3 million jobs across the country. ANGA.US. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at AECF.org. And from Ally Bank, who values straightforward reporting and straightforward banking. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com. This is NPR.